This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. We know that current turmoil over failing banks, subprime mortgages, federal bailouts, well, probably a lot of you are shaking in your financial boots at the moment. Well, today we want you to think not so much about this week, but ask you to step back and take a look at family finances over the last quarter century. Peter Goslin, economic reporter for the LA Times, has taken a trip into the checkbooks and bank accounts of the American family for the last generation and finds that most of us are doing better in the less regulated, more market-driven world, but that this prosperity comes with new risks. The social safety net is so much thinner than it used to be, Goslin says, that one income-changing event, unemployment, say, or illness, can trigger financial ruin. If that describes you, call and tell us your story. Our phone number here in Washington is 800-989-8255. Email us, talk@npr.org. You can also join the conversation on our blog at npr.org/blogofthenation. Later in the hour, a travel writer looks at life from the other side of the aisle as a flight attendant. But first, the risks of greater risk. Peter Goslin is a national economics correspondent for the Los Angeles Times, the author of the new book, High Wire, The Precarious Financial Lives of American Families. He joins us here in Studio 3A. Nice to have you on the program today.
Thank you for having me.
And you illustrate your point through the wrenching stories of people who are totally undone. And you begin your book with a decidedly upper middle class family. Tell us about Deborah Potter.
Deborah Potter is a great soul and one of the interviews I enjoyed the most. She is the wife of a Presbyterian preacher in Winchester, Virginia, and the couple have five kids. And in the early 80s, she was a stay-at-home mom and a minister's wife, and it dawned on the couple that they were never going to get five kids through college.
Right.
on a preacher's wages. And she decided to do something about it. And what she did is she went out and it's a great American story. She went out and she got her insurance license. And over the course of the next two plus decades, she made herself into one of the biggest insurance agents in the state of Virginia and in the nation, selling mostly group health and disability policies to employers to help their employees. And then she got sick. She got what turned out to be MS, multiple sclerosis, and the very insurance company whose policies she had just been selling wouldn't cover her. And it took her almost 4 years hiring a lawyer and a very large story in a big American newspaper to get that decision reversed. So that's the story of
and,
Potter.
And it illustrates a couple of points you make in your book, one of which is more and more of us are dependent on two incomes for our families, and the loss of one of those incomes can be a disaster.
That's right. But I think the thing that it illustrates more importantly is that the real safety net for most of us are not the things you hear about in the public discussion, the safety nets that are provided by Washington, welfare or Social Security or Medicare.
Unemployment insurance.
There are employer-provided benefits. There are health and disability and life policies that are the things that are important to the vast, vast majority of Americans. Here is a woman who had one of those safety nets. Not only did she have one, but she was an expert in the provision one. She was an insurance insider, a benefit insider, and this safety net just broke right out from under her when she fell.
And she thought she was covered. She thought she was okay.
She thought she was covered, and she was simply flabbergasted, and she's very quite straightforward about it, when it turned out that she wasn't covered. One of the things that this shows is the fine-grained ways in which things have changed over the last generation. In the case of our employer-provided benefits, none of us, except for a very small group of lawyers who specialize in this, would know this. But the truth is that the reason why what happened to Potter could happen is that over the past generation, an increasingly conservative Supreme Court and federal appeals court bench have rendered a series of decisions about the one law, the only law, essentially, that covers employer-provided benefits. It's called ERISA, the Employment Retirement Income Security Act of 1974. They've rendered a series of decisions that have made it increasingly easier for insurance companies, for employers, for insurance companies, for benefit administrators to deny or limit the benefits you get under your employer-provided benefits, and increasingly harder for you to depend on them as a real safety net.
Tell us another story. This is about a former Arthur Andersen executive named Bruce Meyer.
Bruce Meyer is an executive lives in Atlanta, Georgia now, and he set about climbing the corporate ladder like there was no tomorrow, going from small companies to larger ones. He ended up for a while working at what was for a little bit the nation's largest phone company, mm-hmm. WorldCom, and then ended at what seemed like a rock of Gibraltar in the corporate world, Arthur Andersen. Andersen collapsed during the corporate scandals of 2002, and Bruce Meyer found himself without a job. He continued to lead. And he has been without an executive job or any steady employment for going on 5 years now, maybe a little longer, maybe almost six by now. He has, I want to be clear, this is somebody who manages to get enough consulting jobs that he continues to lead a reasonable life. He plays the same sort of role you would think of as an executive playing in the social life of Atlanta. Until recently, he was the president of the Dogwood Festival, which is sort of the opening of the spring social season in Atlanta. The problem is that he can't get back on the corporate up escalator or get back in the regular workforce. Again, here is, I think the story here is, I don't ask you to weep over Bruce Meyer. He has managed to tide himself over, but he is living without any of the stability or certainty that most Americans, there may be a few who don't, but most Americans believe they need to lead reasonable, humane lives and make decisions like getting married, having kids, raising children, and getting into college and so forth.
Let's get some callers in on the conversation. Our guest, Peter Goslin, we're talking about his new book, Highwire, The Precarious Financial Lives of American Families, 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. And we'll begin with Lee, and Lee's calling us from Columbia, South Carolina.
Yes, hi, everybody. I'm a self-employed independent trucker from Oregon, and for the last 8 years, my diesel fuel costs have gone from $15,000 to $80,000 a year. And I started understanding what it's like living on a high wire. I mean, every year things get worse and worse. And frankly, I'm just one mechanical disaster, one health disaster from going bankrupt.
And as the economy slows a little bit, Lee, money's getting harder to borrow. You must be very worried.
Actually, in my experience, and I travel all over the country. The economy's been slowing, incrementally for the last 8 years.
Lee is an example of somebody I think who has maybe the iron gut it takes to go out on your own. I mean, that's a special breed of people who are self-employed. Most Americans are employed by companies that provide them with some protections, even if they're not generous benefits. The very security of knowing you're going to pay a paycheck next week has been a very important safety net for people to be able to make, as I said, the kind of decisions that you have to make to get through life. And those certainties are no longer there. In some sense, we're all living like Lee is living as self-employed.
As independent agents.
Yeah. Freelancers.
Lee, thanks very much for the call, and good luck. We hope prices come down for you. I wanted to ask you, you trace this back. This is a societal thing that you trace back to the Mayflower Compact, the agreement by those people who stepped off the Mayflower, not all of them members of the Pilgrim sect. Indeed, many of them were not. So it was important to reach an agreement about what individual rights were, what individual responsibilities were, and what the community's responsibilities were.
The reason I cite the Mayflower is, look, we have spent a generation in this country praising the wonders of the free market and the ability of each person to sort of forge their own financial future. And I wanted to remind my readers that while this absolutely is a country born of dreams of individual success and wealth, it has also been a country for most of its history that has accepted that there are some minimal set of obligations that we have to each other to take care of each other. What is striking about the Mayflower Compact is that at this moment of peril, at the very beginning of white settlement of this continent, the Pilgrims and William Bradford found themselves facing a mutiny of the non-Pilgrims on board, and he called a meeting, and out of that meeting emerged a document that tried to say, and said in very terse terms, look, these are the obligations. We agree to subordinate ourselves to some minimal set of requirements that we survive together as a society. And then we can go off and do what we will after that. But I think one of the things that has been largely forgotten, at least forgotten until this recent crisis, is that both those things, both those poles, forging your own future and depending on a community to provide you with certain minimal protections, both those are in our history.
We're talking more with Peter Goslin about the precarious financial lives of American families in just a moment. We also want to hear your stories. Has somehow the rug been pulled from underneath your family financial structure? Give us a call. Tell us your story. 800-989-8255. Email us talk@npr.org. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News. This is Talk of the Nation. I'm Neil Conan in Washington. In his new book, Peter Goslin argues that many American families are one step away from financial disaster. An example, Goslin estimates that some 60% of all homeowners don't have enough insurance to replace their home if disaster strikes, and they may not know that until they have to file a claim. In the aftermath of Hurricanes Hannah and Ike, that could be devastating to homeowners along the Gulf Coast. You can read an excerpt from Highwire, The Precarious Financial Lives of American Families, at our website at npr.org/talk. Peter Goslin is our guest today, national economics correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. If you'd like to join us, if you've had experiences like this, give us a call, 800-989-8255. Email is talk@npr.org. And let's go to Rachel. Rachel's with us on the line from Ann Arbor in Michigan.
Hi, can you hear me?
Yes, you're on the air, Rachel. Go ahead, please.
Thank you for taking my call. Well, I just wanted to call in with my story. I, like the woman in that initial story, have multiple sclerosis. And one of the little-known side effects of MS, or manifestations, is cognitive dysfunction. It's actually the primary reason why people with MS are forced to leave the workplace early. So this has occurred with me. I've been unable to hold down a job. I've gone through 4 jobs in the last year and a half or so. And I'm going on 40. If it weren't for the good graces of my family and their economic stability, I would be homeless and, you know, at soup kitchens. I'm trying to collect unemployment. The unemployment agency first tried to. They first said you have to prove you're disabled. Now I proved I'm disabled. And now they said, well, you can't work full time, so you don't qualify for unemployment. Now I'm trying to work to prove that I can work full time. It's a bureaucratic nightmare.
Yeah, it sounds like
job.
a It sounds like a really difficult situation.
It's a horrible situation. Yeah. It's terrible. Yeah.
I think
and
that
it's really driven home the point to me that I am so fortunate because luckily my parents have been able to generously help support me. So I have an apartment, I have food, I have health insurance through Cobra and now my parents' small business, but
let me see if I can draw a broader moral from this. Look, it's always the case that some people are going to have terrible setbacks in life. I mean, it's the nature of life. What I think is striking about the last generation is that we've essentially laid the groundwork for more and more people when they're hit with troubles. I mean, no government agency or employer caused Rachel to have MS. I don't think. I don't know her full story, but I mean, it's a guess. Let me just finish. But once hit, do we have any arrangement to provide for that person? And my argument in the book is that those kind of safety nets have either been substantially weakened or have been ripped away over the last 25 to 30 years.
And Rachel, you obviously look into the future. You've been fortunate through your parents and their business to have some relief, but that's not going to last forever either.
No, my parents aren't, a Hilton. They can't support me forever. And, you know, it's terrifying and it's incredibly demoralizing. And it's really driven home the point to me that this country really doesn't have much of a support system. I don't know what people in other situations do that don't have family that are able to help. They must just become homeless and go to soup kitchens. I really don't know.
Yeah.
Rachel, we wish you the best of luck.
Thank you very much.
Thanks for the call.
Let me just make another point about that. You can take any of a number of views of the story we just heard. One is, that's life. It's tough. Some people get hit. Or you can take the view that, look, we do have our obligations to each other are great enough that we should be helping people like Rachel. I think one of the points that I try to make in the book is whichever position, whether you're a free market conservative who believes you Rachel and everybody else should make it on their own, or whether you're dyed in the wool liberal and believe that we ought to have safety nets for everything, one thing that's true about what's happened is that it has happened in such an incremental and in such a quiet way that most people don't know. For example, most people don't know that the law that protects them, that gives them the right to their benefit and the remedy if they don't get their employer-provided benefits, has been fundamentally altered. So that these things have changed incrementally over time, and we have ended up taking on more and more risk. And so if you don't let people know that they're taking on more risk, then they're not going to be prepared when the danger actually hits.
But other people would argue, look, there's a combination of risk and reward. Yes, we have more risks, but we have greater opportunities, too, because this market economy has made it possible for some people to really go out and make that American dream.
Yeah, or at least they'd argue it up until
few
months.
Maybe until Monday, yeah.
But I absolutely agree. And one of the things that I tried to do in this book is that there is a nasty habit that economics journalists have who are trying to say there's something different happening and that is they often veer into being prosperity deniers. Look, the truth of the matter is America today is, even after the mess of the last year, is much richer than it was in 1980. But so I was, the whole of the book is an attempt to try to figure out how to reconcile the notion that the economy as a whole could be more prosperous, and yet Americans feel less secure, and some take these huge economic falls.
Let's get Harry on the line. Harry's with us from Dodgeville in Wisconsin.
I would say that the primary factor that's driving this is greed. I mean, if you look at the economic times that we're in right now, the subprime issues, if people didn't try to purchase homes that they couldn't afford in the first place, a lot of these people wouldn't be in the economic situation that they're in now.
Harry, I understand what you're saying, and there absolutely are a subset of people who basically made their own mess. I don't doubt that for a minute. But what I try to do in the book is ask the question, is this thing more general than that? So there's a chapter that has some numbers that may leave people confused, but it's an attempt to look across essentially a nationally representative sample of 5,000 families and all of their spin-offs over 40 years and ask, has their situation changed in ways that leave them more at risk? And what I argue in a variety of ways is, yes, there have been these changes. And so while of some cases, some small subset of cases may be explained by greed, I think that we've got a broader trend here than just that.
I guess depending on how you skew the numbers, you can make them say whatever you want.
Lies, damned lies and statistics, Harry. Thanks very much for the call.
Thank you.
Bye-bye. Let's see if we can get Adam. Adam's on the line with us from San Rafael in California.
Thanks, Neil. I wanted to just share a thought that was sparked by the call from the trucker in Oregon. The thought has to do with where this notion of stability comes from, where people think stability is coming from. I worked for a major corporation for 10 years, a company of 72,000 people, and was laid off when the company was acquired by another company. I then worked for a research institute of 800 people, a very prestigious research institute, and then that program was reorganized, and I was laid off from that job. And now I work for myself independently, and surprisingly, I think there's actually more stability and predictability for my family in this kind of independent consulting mode, because I have six different clients, and if one of them terminates me, I still have five others, and so on. So it's definitely a hustle, but in some ways, I'm spending less time in bureaucratic meetings and so on, and in a funny way, I have more stability for my family than I did when I was working for a big company.
There are certainly people who prosper as self-employed freelancers, if you will. I just raised some questions with you. How, given that the real economy is slowing, may soon be officially declared as being in recession, how certain are you about those six clients? What are you paying for your health insurance, which I presume you have to buy for yourself? Do you have a family, and do you have kids, and what are you paying for their health insurance? Most Americans have had the option of going in that direction, and although in the direction of being sort of self-employed, independent contractors, and the fraction of the American workforce that has actually chosen that option is remarkably small.
I totally agree with you that it's not a choice for everyone. It turns out I do have kids, and actually a kid with a chronic illness, and so insurance issues are incredibly important to me, and that's another conversation. But in terms of where stability comes from, I guess the only thing I'd want to add to the conversation is that I think people, even in big companies and big institutions, have to act in some ways like independent consultants. They have to advocate for themselves. They can't just count on some big structure to support them, because a lot of the fundamentals that used to allow big institutions to provide, you know, pensions and insurance and so on, are eroding. And so people have to take on this mentality of hustling and looking out for themselves more, almost no matter where they are.
Okay, that does make sense to me. But again, on this issue of can you in effect create your own stability, your own material stability, economic stability? I mean, the truth of the matter is that, you know, we invented. I mean, at its very nub, what insurance is, what all kinds of insurance, whether we're talking about auto insurance or homeowners insurance or a public insurance such as unemployment compensation, it is a pooling of risk. The fundamental notion behind it is that each person alone faces a very dangerous world if they actually do it alone. And so what we do is, for in a variety of places, we toss into a pot a certain amount, our premiums, or in the case of unemployment compensation, some tax dollars sometimes, or and the losers draw from it, and the winners, who don't get unemployed or don't have a health crisis, get the certainty that were they hit, you know, they know where the provision, where the security, they can be secure where the where their help will come from. So I agree that people need to be, I think people need to be a lot more aware of the dangers that face them, and the fact that their protections are not as firm as they think they are. But the notion that they can go without them, I think, is not the way most Americans live or have.
Thanks very much for the call, Adam.
Thank you.
And another of the points that Peter Goslin makes in the book is that unemployment, until recently perhaps, relatively more rare than it has been at other times in our economic past, but can be more persistent. Here's an email from Gene in North Carolina. My husband was laid off in 1999 as a result of NAFTA. He was 49 for 3 years. He was essentially unemployed. Since that time, he's not been able to replace his white-collar job. He now works two jobs, leaving the house at 2:30 in the morning, coming home at 5:30 p.m. He works in the service sector and cannot get back into management. He's even ceased to try. My husband's dilemma is not uncommon. This country has ceased to appreciate the older, more educated, and experienced worker. You're listening to Talk of the Nation from NPR News. Peter?
I was just going to say, I mean, actually, this the enterprise of this book started with an interview with somebody who was an executive at one of the it was at a time when unemployment was particularly low, but here was a guy in a white collar job who was out a really long time. And if you start looking at the statistics, you realize that there has again been this trade off. The headline unemployment rate number has gone down, but not noticed by most people. The median duration of unemployment, how long you're out if you end up out, if you fall off the horse and don't have a job, has gone up. And when people try to measure the risk of anything, it's not just the frequency with which bad stuff can happen to you. It's the frequency times how bad it could be if it happens. So in the case of unemployment, the danger to Americans is not just captured by every month by the unemployment rate that the Bureau of Labor Statistics puts out. It's captured by that plus how long they're out if they end up out. And the argument of the book is that in a whole variety of areas, it's not that you have individual Americans and their families haven't been prosperous. It's just if they lose the source of that prosperity, they can more easily lose the source of that prosperity. And if they lose it, if they lose an important job, if they have one of these health crises, the damage that can be done is much greater than it used to be.
Peter, we just have a couple of minutes left, but I want to ask you to put on your other hat as National Economics Correspondent for the Los Angeles Times. And we have seen an amazing week. The United States government now owns 70% of the mortgages in this country and now owns the largest insurance company in the world. What is going on here?
Look, this is an astounding time. My knowledge of the financial system and the economy goes back to the 70s, and I've seen a lot of dicey times, and this is the diciest I've ever seen. I mean, what is happening is that Federal Reserve Chairman Ben Bernanke and Treasury Secretary Henry Paulson are basically putting the federal government and the nation's central bank square in the way of what can only be described as a huge financial panic. And they are saying, we are going to stand here and we are going to stop it.
Horatio at the bridge.
It is, absolutely. And my hat is off to them. I mean, they are particularly Secretary Paulson, who came here from the financial markets, whose every ideological fiber tells him not to do what he's doing, has set aside these preconceptions and is simply about the task of trying to stop this. I just want to say, I mean, what's interesting about this panic so far is, and one of the things that I think confuse people is that thus far it's been a battle of the titans. It has been big institutional investors yanking money from big institutions like big investment banks. But it's already going to have an effect on us because it's going to reduce growth. But it's getting close. It is at that moment where it could tip into affecting your finances and mine, our money market accounts, are the things that the institutions that you and I regularly deal with and that most Americans regularly deal with.
And at the last glance, the stock market up 423 points today. The roller coaster continues. Peter Goslin, thank you so much for that analysis and for talking with us about your new book, which is called High Wire, The Precarious Financial Lives of American Families. And good luck to you.
Thank you. Thank you very much.
Coming up, we're going to be talking with the travel writer for The New York Times. Please return to your seats. Fasten your seatbelts. We'll find out what it's like to work in the cabin as a flight attendant, because she did. I'm Neil Conan. Stay with us. It's the Talk of the Nation from NPR News.